Welcome, everybody, to our MDU podcast on reflection. I'm Caroline Fryer, Head of Advisory Services here at the MDU, and I'm joined today by Laura Humes, a GP trainee who's been doing some work with the MDU on complaints and the support that people need with them, and Daniel Sokol, who is the founder for the Centre for Remedial Ethics. He's also a medical ethicist and a barrister. He writes the medical ethics column in the BMJ, and he's helped a number of our MDU members facing GMC processes with reflection. So welcome both. In terms of reflection, we as an organisation know how important that is after an adverse event. It can make a huge difference to the outcome for our members in terms of the way a case goes. So we often advise reflection. But I guess my first question for you, Daniel, is, well, what would you advise in terms of reflection? What does it really mean as far as you're concerned? How do you advise that doctors begin that process?
Well, the first thing to say is that there isn't a single way of doing reflection. But I think what's important is to start thinking early about what went wrong, assuming you're writing about something that went wrong, why it went wrong, and what can be done to minimize the risk of it going wrong again. It's important, I think, to write something down early when matters are still fresh in your mind, when you can remember what happened, but you can also remember why you acted in the way that you did, and also remember how you felt when all this happened. So time is key, and the more time you give yourself to write your reflective statement, the deeper and more sophisticated it's probably going to be. So don't leave it to the last minute. Don't do it all in one sitting. It's kind of a low, slow cooking process. So when I have to write an argument for court, for example, I try not to write it just the day before the hearing. I try to do it some days in advance so that I have time to go over it, to improve it. And also, even when you're not working on it, you're thinking about it. And so, I may be having dinner or, in bed, and suddenly I think of a great analogy that makes the argument clearer and more persuasive. And I was just thinking earlier that, in fact, a reflective statement is a persuasive document, ultimately. You're trying to persuade the reader that you have properly reflected on something. In cases with GMC, of course, or MPTS, you're trying to persuade the readers, the decision makers, that you've gained insight. So it is a persuasive document, and it's a document that you have to keep working on. So create a rough draft of your reflective statement early on and make it, I think they call this a living document, where you basically, it evolves as your own thinking evolves, and you can change it as you go on. What else? I also encourage doctors to read and do some research. So, for example, if you are in trouble and you have to write a reflective statement, read past cases of the MPTS, past judgments. See what impresses the tribunal and what disappoints them. And you can obviously find those on the MPTS website. So, for example, let's say you've been accused of breaching a professional boundary, for example. You're going to find dozens of cases about that on the MPTS website. And if you did, you might read something like, and this is from an actual judgment, "The tribunal identified the following aggravating factor. Dr. X displayed a lack of empathy and understanding of the impact of his actions on patient A." Well, that's really helpful to you, right? Because it's a reminder that in your reflective statement, you should make sure that you demonstrate a full understanding and awareness of the effect that your behavior had or could have had on your patients and perhaps on members of the public. So basically, to think about multiple perspectives. Someone once said that it's a sign of wisdom to learn from the mistakes of others as opposed to your own. And that's what you're doing when you're reading these other cases of the MPTS. You're looking at how other people have screwed up and also what they've done well. And you're basically benefiting, reaping the benefits of their errors. What else? Read the advice, obviously, of the GMC and the BMA and your professional bodies. So the Royal College of Psychiatrists has a good document on probity. But remember that it's not enough to just cite the guidance. You've got to show an understanding. Don't just say, "Oh, well, yeah, I was dishonest." And if you look at the GMC, it says be honest and trustworthy. So, yeah, Well, that's, you know, that's not very good. It's not very insightful. You need to explain, well, why is there that rule that doctors should be honest and trustworthy? You have to show that you understand why the rule exists. And you could also benefit from reading other books and essays from doctors who are really good at reflection. One of my favorites is Sir William Osler, the Canadian doctor, probably the most famous doctor of the 20th century. And a while ago, I was rereading one of his essays called L'Envoi, The Sending Off. And this was a speech that he gave in 1905 in America before he was about to go and take up his position as Regius Professor of Medicine in Oxford. And so it was to loads of people, loads of clinicians. He was already very, very famous at that time. And at the end of the speech, he said, I have made mistakes, but they've been mistakes of the head, not the heart. And at the time, I was representing a clinician. You know, he hadn't followed guidelines, but he had good intentions. He was generally trying to help the patient. And when I read that line, I immediately thought, this is perfect. This is perfect for my case. I could refer to Osler's text and say to the decision maker, yes, my client made a mistake in doing this, but it was a mistake of the head, not the heart. And those mistakes are much more amenable to correction. So, and I got that from reading, you know, and I would definitely encourage doctors who have to write these reflective statements to read books like that, Osler, Richard Selzer, the surgeon, Atul Gawande, Paul Kanatiki. There are loads of those sources, and read them, see how they do it, and learn from them. And the final thing, I've spoken too long and answered that question already, but the final thing I would say is talk to other people about your reflective statement. Discuss it with friends, with colleagues, with spouses, and they'll give you, you know, they might give you ideas. They might point out things that are not very good or that are, you know, that can be improved. And so you'll learn from them as well. So those are my top tips, I think.
Thank you for those tips on how to get started with the reflective process, Daniel. I have to say, I've never really sat down and started reading around the subject before I've started writing something in my portfolio. So that's a really helpful bit of advice on how to get things started. Getting down to the specifics, really, of what should be included in a piece of reflective writing. Have you got any examples of perhaps good versus inadequate reflection that you could give us?
Well, in terms of what should be included, so the Academy of Medical Royal Colleges has a document which is really helpful called a Reflective Practice Toolkit. And in that document, they define reflective practice as this, okay? The process whereby an individual thinks analytically about anything relating to their professional practice. So I guess you can reflect on good stuff as well as bad stuff, but most people reflect on bad stuff, with the intention of gaining insight and using the lessons learned to maintain good practice or make improvements where possible. The key words here are analytically, insight and improvements. And the biggest mistake that I see when I read reflective statements, and I've read quite a few, is the lack of analysis and the lack of evidence of insight. So I had one the other day, a client of mine, who produced a reflective statement, and his reflective statement was a list, okay, bullet points, which said things like, I shall not work without proper rest. I shall make contemporaneous notes of my patient consultations. I shan't make a fraudulent claim against my home insurer. That kind of thing. A bit like Bart Simpson when he writes his stuff on the chalkboard. And that doesn't really show any, there's no depth to that. There's no analysis to that. It's just a statement. And as a doctor, you want to demonstrate that you understand why it's important or why it's potentially harmful and unwise to work if you're too tired, why it's important to make contemporaneous notes and so on. So a good reflective statement is rich. It's not superficial. It digs beneath the surface and it requires you to keep asking questions. You know, why did I act in this way? How would this be perceived by patients and so on? So the biggest, you know, as I said, the biggest flaw that I see is that the statements are just too superficial. And that may be related to what I said earlier. They don't spend enough time on it because often your first draft may well be pretty superficial. You're stating the obvious, but the more you think about it, the more you enrich it and it makes it deeper. Now, many of the statements that I read are full of phrases like, I have reflected a lot. I mean, this is a real extract. I have reflected a lot about what happened. I've reflected on my mistakes, understood them, and learned from them. I've grasped the opportunity to reflect. And this is all from the same statement, by the way. In other words, the writer thinks that by repeating the words reflection or reflect and insight lots of times, that will persuade the reader that they've developed reflection and insight. And in fact, the best reflective statements, when you read them, the reflection and the insight emerges naturally from the text, from the content. You don't need to say, oh, I've reflected a lot about this. It's obvious when you read it. When you read a good reflective statement, which is truly insightful and truly rich and sophisticated, as a reader, you think, oh, wow, I hadn't thought about that. That person's really thought about what's happened here. And the bad ones, you just read them and you think, I'm just stating the obvious. I have no idea whether this person actually understands why they've gone wrong. And also, if it's possible, you should show that you've made concrete changes to your practice as a result of your thinking or your training. So don't just say, oh, I went on an ethics course and it was interesting. Say, well, in an attempt to deepen my understanding of the ethical issues in this case, I attended an ethics course on this date. And as part of the course, we looked in detail at relevant sections of the Hippocratic Oath. And I was struck by the passage instructing doctors, not to seduce their patients, for example. And this is, of course, reflected in the current guidance of the GMC on maintaining professional boundaries, which says this: until then, I hadn't fully appreciated why it was so important to have this boundary. And then you go on to explain why it is important to have that boundary, and that if you are permitted to continue practicing, if you're in that tricky situation, then that you've got something in place to ensure that this boundary is never going to be crossed again. So you're demonstrating that you've actually learned something concrete from your reflection.
Thank you, Daniel. It's very helpful. And we, like you, have seen so many of these reflective pieces that are very, very shallow. And I think what you're saying is really thinking about how did this happen? What were the factors in play when this particular event took place? How can I avoid those happening next time? What will I do myself to put me in a better position are really helpful. And as you say, it's not about I've now decided I'm going to write contemporaneous notes. It's about the how are you going to do that? What was it that stopped you from being able to write those contemporaneous notes last time? And what are you therefore able to change about your practice that will prevent that happening again? So there's some really helpful tips in there. Yeah. And I mean, in our experience, much like yours, the power of good reflection and insight can significantly influence the outcome for doctors in terms of disciplinary or GMC investigations, and actually at a much lower level in terms of resolving complaints. Because of course, we know when patients complain that they want an apology and an explanation, but most of all, they want reassurance that something isn't going to happen again. And that reflective piece is so much part of that. And so we see at the MDU that helping resolve many complaints. But you're dealing with things at your Centre for Remedial Ethics at a much sort of harsher end of the spectrum. So do you have examples where you feel, yes, it really was the reflection that made the difference here in terms of outcome?
I think it often makes a big difference. And if you look at the judgments of the MPTS, you will occasionally see express mention of a doctor's reflections as playing a part in their decision-making. So it's definitely a document that the panel reads, and it's therefore an opportunity for you as a doctor to influence the panel before you even step into the hearing. It's a great opportunity. And if it's engaging, if it's impressive, then the panel is probably going to be more favorably disposed towards you. And on the other hand, if it's poorly written and superficial, then that might raise concerns about your insight and your remediation. It might even raise concerns about whether you're taking this thing seriously at all. Especially for doctors who are in trouble with disciplinary issues, it may well be one of the most important documents they will ever write. And it's so important that they devote proper time and attention to it. Now, one of the doctors that did my course was undergoing a disciplinary process for dishonesty. Just to give you an example, he'd falsified an employment certificate and sent it as proof that he'd worked for this locum agency. And the tribunal, in its judgment, referred to the fact that he'd done an ethics course and added, Dr. X has engaged properly in reflecting upon the fundamental tenet of probity required for a member of the medical profession. He's reflected on the adverse impact of a failure to adhere to these standards. He's adequately remediated the adverse impact on public confidence. The tribunal therefore determined he was no longer impaired by reason of dishonesty. And I have absolutely no doubt that his reflective statement played a part in that positive outcome. I mean, another advantage, of course, of writing a good reflective statement and spending time on it is that the very process of doing it is going to help you when you go to the tribunal or the hearing. When you're faced with those questions and you have to demonstrate that you do have insight under considerable pressure. I mean, it may well be the barrister who asks you these questions. And you want to be thinking, you don't want to be thinking about these matters for the first time in that hearing, you know. So if you write a good statement and you spend time on it, those questions will not come as a surprise to you. You will have thought about them and you're much more likely to give a good, persuasive, impressive answer than if you just think of it on the hoof on the day. So well worth spending time on it.
And of course, the quality of reflections is really important. As a trainee, I'm very aware of the quantity I'm encouraged to write in my training portfolio and such. There is very much a quota of reflections for us to include from various learning events.
What is the quota? Out of interest.
I think in the GP training program at the moment, a couple of reflections a week is what is the minimum.
Wow, that is a lot. So, is there a maximum length?
I don't think there's a word count, no. So it isn't capped, but certainly in that sort of culture of having to do them, I think that can lead to people cutting corners and not approaching them perhaps in the same way as you're describing. But reflections are, of course, at a much lower level of sort of learning event than these more adverse events that yourself and Caroline have been discussing. Certainly one thing that comes out amongst trainees is that after the Bawagaba case, there is a lot of concern from trainees that what they write in their reflections in their portfolios, for example, might be used in some way to incriminate them or used against them in some way. What are your views on that?
Well, I think strictly speaking, it's correct. Reflective statements are not privileged documents, which means that they can be disclosed as part of litigation. So if a patient were to sue a hospital or a GP practice or a GP individually, and that GP wrote a reflective statement about that particular case, then this may well be disclosable as part of the disclosure exercise, whether or not it helps the case or harms it. So doctors have to be aware of this possibility and they have to use their judgment as to what they put in their reflective statement. And if they're not sure what to put in, they should probably get advice from the defense organization or a lawyer. But, you know, always maintain, you know, the basic rules apply. You should always maintain confidentiality. With reflective statements, as you know, you don't really need to go into great detail about the facts of the case. That's not really the focus of the exercise. The focus is on reflection and learning rather than recounting precisely what happened. But no, I mean, it's definitely something that trainees ought to be aware of, that it is theoretically possible for these documents to be disclosed as part of litigation.
So your advice, perhaps, if there is signs that it could become a more significant adverse incident, would be to get that advice prior to writing anything in these disclosable portfolios, perhaps?
Absolutely, yeah. That's the prudent thing to do, yeah.
And that, I mean, that is always our advice, as you will know, Laura, from your time working with me and the team. In terms of any adverse event, we always suggest before you put pen to paper, or certainly hand the paper or electronic version of to anybody else, that you should seek advice from your defence organisation, because of course that's what we're here for. I mean, what I would say on this point about reflection is, usually it's helpful. So whilst the GMC does not require that people submit reflective documents as part of their bundle of evidence if it's going forward to a case, nearly always we would want to do that. So people shouldn't be discouraged or worried that they're, in most cases, likely to write something that will incriminate them. Usually, it's helpful, as Daniel set out all the many reasons why, this is a helpful process. So to have this document is useful. We know, in fact, the reflective document was not used in the Bauer Garber case against her. And this, again, comes back to the facts of the cases, and the reflection document not being about the facts particularly, but about the learning. We know that's the case. It's been confirmed by those that represented her. But nonetheless, it is a rumour that, continues to be out there. And for good reason, as Daniel said, because these are not privileged documents. But written in the right way, with learning in mind and reflection in mind, in our experience, they are almost universally helpful, unless they say things that Daniel has referred to where they're not at all reflective. They are a story, but they show actually very little insight or evidence of understanding of the impact on patients, colleagues, or other areas, but nearly always they're helpful. One of the common things, actually, Daniel, that we see flagged from our members is about the sort of systems failings behind things when they go wrong, and the impact of those on the reflective document. Because, of course, the idea as an individual is to reflect on your individual involvements. But usually when things go wrong, there's that classic Swiss cheese model. There are lots of problems. And what would be your views on how people flag these issues, but while still appearing individually reflective and not as though they're blaming everybody but themselves?
Well, one of the goals of reflection is to identify flaws or limitations in the broader system, and we'd like even to affect change. So as a general rule, I think it would be wrong to shy away from mentioning these things just because you're worried about appearing defensive. And in fact, a reflective piece may be deemed deficient because it fails to take into account the bigger picture. But it is important, I think, for doctors to be honest with themselves and to exercise good judgment when they're thinking about responsibility or who's responsible for this. So if a doctor administered the wrong dose of medication when he or she was exhausted, but instead of accepting any responsibility for it, blames the rotor coordinator who has made it so that he or she had to work 48 hours in a row. Okay, that's not going to go down very well. So there may well be problems with the rotor. There may well be systemic problems with how the rotor is created. And that may have contributed to the tiredness and the error, but that doesn't absolve the doctor of all responsibility. And so blaming the rotor or the rotor coordinator could suggest that the doctor doesn't have insight or doesn't show any remorse or hasn't remediated. So the way that you communicate things is so important in a reflective statement, because you want to come across as measured, as reasonable, as sensible, as respectful. You don't want to come across as somebody who deflects blame and points the finger of blame onto other people, who's ready to find fault with anybody else but themselves. Because accepting responsibility is a sign of insight. So yes, by all means, think and reflect on the broader system and how that may have played a part, but be very careful about coming across as, well, actually, this is nothing to do with me. It's the system that made me do it. Because I think that will cause problems.
Very helpful. It's, as you say, a balanced approach.
Yeah.
And I mean, and one of the other things that sometimes, obviously, people don't know things have gone wrong at the time of their involvement. So it's not at all uncommon for us to have members approach us about incidents that actually happened several years ago, and they've only just found out about them. And then, as you will know only too well, perhaps these then begin life as a claim. But sadly, along the way, there's a referral to the GMC. And these doctors are then trying to reflect on things that they really have very poor recollection of because they happened some time ago. How do you feel you can approach reflection when the doctor just simply does not have a good recollection of the facts and isn't able to do as you advised initially and get that statement started early on?
Well, I mean, all doctors will have been told this, but you cannot overstress the importance of good, complete, legible, accurate contemporaneous notes. There are so many clinical negligent claims and complaints that would never have gone off the ground if there had been good notes. So don't underestimate the value of good notes. You just don't know when those notes are going to save your skin. But yeah, if you don't have a good recollection of the facts, that's going to make reflection much more challenging. You need to convey the limits of your recollection. You obviously don't want to make facts up. So for example, let's imagine that you don't remember if there was a chaperone with you during a particular consultation. I think it's fine to say, well, you know, this event happened 7 years ago. And due to the passage of time and the absence of information in the notes, I cannot, in all honesty, remember whether or not there was a chaperone present. However, offering a chaperone was and remains my practice. And I would very much like to think that I did have a chaperone present. And then you can reflect on why it's so important to have a chaperone present and so on. And if you want, you can then comment on your note keeping if there are things that you can improve or things that you would change to ensure that this doesn't happen again. So it is possible to do that, even if you can't remember perfectly. But again, you have to make clear the limitations of your recollection.
Thank you.
And one theme that did come up in our survey around complaints, Daniel, looking into doctors' experiences of these and what support was needed, was the area of vexatious complaints, where, you know, the doctor's account of things was absolutely in contrast to the patient's little proof of what had gone on, and doctors finding these types of complaints particularly difficult to reflect upon at all. Have you got any advice on how people should approach these sorts of situations?
Well, I think a key skill of doctors is imagination and trying to imagine what things must be like or look like from the perspective of the patient or the relative or whoever who complained, the person who complained, and avoid the temptation of dismissing a complaint as vexatious or frivolous or completely devoid of any merit. So be charitable when you're reflecting on the complaint. Ask yourself, what could have driven this person to take some time out of their day to write a complaint about me? What is it about what I did or what I said or what I conveyed to them that so upset them? And judging from the wording of the complaint, is there anything I could have done differently to avoid the complaint? So you look carefully at the substance of the complaint, but you also look carefully at the wording, the expression of the complaint. You know, was there a misunderstanding? And if so, how did that misunderstanding arise? Did I end the consultation too quickly, too abruptly? Did I say something that might have offended them? So, you know, there are lots of things you could do even with a complaint which you deem to be vexatious, but what's important is to be charitable. Because then you can engage. If you're not charitable, if you say complete waste of time, there's not going to be much richness in your reflection. And there's also the issue of how you handle the complaint yourself. You can reflect on that. You can reflect on how the complaint made you feel. You know, as a doctor, you want to do your best for the patient. And so it's normal to be hurt or offended or affected when a patient or a relative complains about you. And in a way, there may be something wrong with you if you don't think you don't care about a complaint. It might indicate apathy or indifference towards the patient experience. So I think that there's always something to discuss. There's always something to learn and reflect on when you receive a complaint, irrespective of the type of complaint. But you should look at the complaint analytically and charitably, and then you'll get much more out of it.
And thank you, and it's very helpful because, I mean, as Laura said, patients' recollections of consultations and doctors' ones do often differ. So that ability, as you say, to take that step back and put yourself in the patient's shoes, because as you say, most people lead very busy lives. So the fact that they have taken time out to write this complaint would suggest that whatever the doctor's intentions, things really didn't go well from the patient's perspective. So trying to look at it from that point is very helpful. But is there anything else before we draw to a close? Are there any other points that you feel it would be useful for our members to hear about in terms of reflection?
Well, I am very conscious that reflection has a pretty bad reputation amongst doctors. I have to say, I didn't know that GP trainees had to do up to two reflections a week. That is rather a lot. So I can well imagine that there might be reflection fatigue. But if you do give it a chance and you devote proper time and attention to it, then I think it can help you grow and improve as a doctor and even perhaps as a human being. And you may even enjoy it. And who knows, publish it. I mean, I don't see enough reflections published, but I don't see any reasons why they shouldn't be. And of course, if you're a doctor in trouble, either with your trust or with your GMC, then a good reflective statement could make the difference between you being able to continue practicing as a doctor or not. So it's worth spending the time to make that statement as engaging and insightful as it can be.
Fabulous. Thank you very much, Laura, Daniel. Thank you for your time. And it's certainly a very interesting discussion from my perspective. Thank you.
Thank you.
Bye.